Today on the Downeast Journal, we begin our show with an update on Hurricane Matthew. I'm speaking with meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Newport, Laura Pagano. Laura, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
When is North Carolina going to start feeling the effects of Hurricane Matthew?
Well, we're probably going to start noticing the impacts from Hurricane Matthew, probably starting Saturday afternoon into the overnight on Sunday. And we're not out of the woods when we get into the day on Sunday either. The actual hurricane and its center will be to our south, and it will be drifting off to the south and east on Sunday. So we'll have residual impacts as it exits on Sunday.
I understand one of the main impacts from the storm is going to be heavy rainfall. How much rain are you predicting for the region?
Well, for eastern North Carolina, we're seeing up to 12 inches of rain, maybe even higher amounts. We're starting to see higher amounts coming in, maybe even 15 inches of rain when all of this is said and done.
There's already a flash flood watch in effect for the area. Flooding, another major concern with this hurricane, right?
Yes, it is. So we're not only going to see river flooding, we're also going to be seeing inland flooding. We're going to see coastal flooding as well. We'll have surge impacts as we have this east-northeast flow. So we'll be seeing water backing up into some of the rivers along the sounds. So that is also an issue. And with all this water coming down, not only from the surge, but obviously we're having rain. It has nowhere to go, so we're going to see flash flooding impacts all across eastern North Carolina.
With this significant flooding, is there any way that you could compare it to a past storm?
We are certainly starting to reference Floyd here. We're starting to see values that are nearing that. We're starting to get worried about some of the impacts, and we're starting to reference Floyd with this as we're starting to see values from the models getting into the 12 to 15-inch range. So needless to say, people need to be preparing now for flash flooding all across eastern North Carolina.
You said widespread flooding is expected. Are there specific areas that you can mention that will experience more flooding, that are prone to flooding?
It's hard to narrow at this time because it's going to be developing. So we're really wherever the track lies, and we're going to get some banding setting up, which is very hard for us to predict. So we're kind of blanketing much of eastern North Carolina. So we're talking, getting down towards Wilmington, up towards New Bern, and maybe even points further north from that, and possibly even further west than that. But certainly for locations, Onslow, up to Carteret, Mainland, Hyde, Dare, Outer Banks are going to be receiving a lot of rain as well, but really inland. So all the different counties that we have spanning from Wilmington all the way north towards Elizabeth City, so that general area. It's hard to narrow down specifically where the bands will set up, but we're definitely going to be seeing high amounts of rain.
So it's very important those people in low-lying areas should go ahead and start making plans to possibly evacuate ahead of the storm.
Well, yes, low-lying areas are going to be the most susceptible. Anywhere along rivers, estuaries, streams, just need to be aware that, very, very cognizant of the situation that's unfolding.
You mentioned storm surge earlier. Right now, rivers, coastal waters, already a couple feet above normal water levels. How much higher do you expect they'll rise as Hurricane Matthew gets closer?
It's hard to say because the rivers, some of them are further inland, some of them are along closer to the coast. But with the storm surge for portions of northern Carteret, you're looking 2 to 4 feet above ground there. This is evolving, and we are going to be tweaking these numbers, but that's what it's looking like as of right now. So many of these rivers could be seeing moderate to major flood by the end of this event.
How strong will winds be?
The winds will be pretty gusty as it comes up, and I think that the main timing of this is important too because the wind is going to be pushing up a lot of this water. So what we're thinking is that we're going to have winds of 35 knots, getting towards 50 knots, and that's along the coast. So that's something to keep in mind when if people are thinking about going out there this weekend. It is a very, very bad idea. This is a very, very dangerous situation.
Do you think that with those winds, there could be a possibility of some downed trees or power lines?
There's definitely possible. With so much rain, we already have soil that is very saturated. It's going to be even more saturated. So if we have gusts that are going to be fairly high, then it's not out of the question. And people also need to keep in mind that not only is this going to be an issue as we get into Saturday, but Sunday, as the system is pulling out to sea, we oftentimes see very strong winds coming in behind the system. While the precipitation may be dwindling, we will start to see increase in some winds, and that, with the soil being so saturated, will potentially down some trees and power lines.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
We've all seen the bright yellow signs along eastern North Carolina roadways. Share the road.
You're going straight and they pass you and get in front of you and then they turn in front of you. So you have to slam on your brakes, you know, because otherwise you'll hit the car.
Avid cyclist and New Bern resident Joe Bays rides about 100 miles a week, sometimes 200 or 300.
Instead of freaking out, just, hey, you know, pay attention to what you're doing. You know, be careful. And then you get flipped off and then they drive away.
Bays says he's only had a few interactions like this. A far more common issue bicyclists encounter are distracted drivers.
You just have to be careful right now with the texters. You just never know. You see people weaving on the road, and it's pretty dangerous.
Distracted drivers are a danger to all. Last year, there were a total of 621 crashes involving bicyclists and motorists. 18 of those were fatal. Many accidents occur when a car is turning at a driveway or intersection. They also happen when a driver makes a lane change without signaling. Bays has had close calls himself and knows others seriously injured.
And one of them actually had a light on his bike. He was riding early in the morning, and someone, it was a hit and run. And he hit the guy and broke his pelvis, and he was out for a while.
Wow.
Yeah, it took him a few months to come back from that one. And one guy that lives right here in River Bend, it was a minor incident, but he had injured himself pretty bad just because of the fall.
Incidents like that are trending downward, according to Ed Johnson, the acting director of the State Transportation Department's Division of Bicycle and Pedestrian Transportation.
We're down percentage-wise for severe injury and fatalities 4% this year.
Numbers could decrease even more thanks to recent changes in traffic law that aim to make roads more bike-friendly. House Bill 959 became State Law 2016-90 in July. The measure took effect October 1st. When riding at night, bike commuters must now have a lighted lamp on the front and a red light on the rear of the bike that must be visible up to 300 feet, or the operator must wear a reflective vest. Johnson says the requirement is a result of a statewide safety campaign, Watch for Me NC, that promotes bicycle and pedestrian safety. He says law enforcement will be issuing false tickets for bicyclists without proper gear.
And the ticket itself has the bike laws and policies on each side so that they can provide an educational opportunity, as well as an encouragement opportunity for the cyclist or the pedestrian. So we're really looking at that as trying to, instead of issue a citation per se or even a fine, we're trying to have a positive engagement between law enforcement and the user.
The change will mostly affect casual riders, since cyclists like Bays already wear bright colored clothing when riding in the afternoon and night and have reflective gear and LED lights on their bikes.
I think it'll really help. I have a small one on the back of this bike, and that little red light will go a long ways.
Bays is all for increasing visibility at night. As a motorist, he's had a couple of white knuckle moments.
It scares me when I see people riding. They're wearing jeans, a black t-shirt, no lights, and some with no reflectors. And when I come upon that, it surprises me, especially at night. I'm looking for it, and I don't see it. So I know if somebody's not looking for it, they're not going to.
According to statistics from NCDOT, most bicycle-related accidents occur in the afternoon and evening when motorists are commuting home from work. Johnson says a change to the law that took effect October 1st allows motorists to safely pass someone on a bike.
A bicyclist or a moped that's proceeding in the same direction as the faster-moving vehicle, the faster-moving vehicle can pass the cyclist or the moped and give them, by law, 4 feet. Or they also can move into and cross over the double yellow line in order to give that safe distance of crossing around a cyclist or someone on a moped.
Drivers are still prohibited from passing in a portion of highway marked with signs or markers indicating that passing should not be attempted. If a bicyclist changes lanes or goes off the side of the road to avoid an accident, the motorist could be fined no less than $200. If there's a crash resulting in property damage or injury, there's a penalty of $500 or more. Another section of the new law deals with increasing communication between drivers and bicyclists. In addition to turning signals, drivers must now use hand signals when turning or stopping.
The motorist using the left hand to extend their arm in a horizontal way and pointing with their forefinger that they're indicating a left turn, or even with the right turn that their upper arm with a horizontal forearm and their hand pointed upward, that they're going to indicate a right turn. And then the stop would be the opposite of that, the upper arm horizontal, the forearm and hand pointed down.
The measure requiring hand signals and allowing drivers to cross the center line took effect October 1st. The rule requiring bicyclists to wear a reflective vest or attach lights and reflectors to their bike will become effective December 1st. The law change comes on the heels of Governor Pat McCrory's new initiative, Vision Zero, which sets the goal to eliminate roadway fatalities in North Carolina. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Addiction to heroin and other opioids is a nationwide epidemic hitting eastern North Carolina hard, very hard. The latest figures from the CDC have four eastern North Carolina counties with drug overdose rates above the state average, and a recent study from a major healthcare provider put two eastern North Carolina cities in the top 25 nationwide for high rates of opioid abuse. Widespread addiction to opioids, including heroin, can have a crippling impact on families and the community as a whole. Today on the Downeast Journal, Chris Thomas explores how opioids affect the mind and body, what makes their appeal so strong, and the habit so hard to break.
Three communities east of I-95 have some of the highest rates of opioid abuse in the United States. At the top of that list, Wilmington, North Carolina, in New Hanover County. Carla Turner says she's never witnessed anything like it. She's the personal health services manager at the New Hanover County Health Department.
People say, why is that? I don't know if it's because we're a tourist town with a large college. I don't know if it's because we have I-40, which feeds into Wilmington. We're not too far from I-95. We're a port city. So I think it could be any number of things.
Jacksonville came in 12th, and Fayetteville was ranked 18th in the report on opioid abuse published by Castle Light Health, a San Francisco-based, publicly traded healthcare information company. Beyond addiction, the number of unintentional drug-related deaths in North Carolina has tripled, from just over 300 in the year 2000 to nearly 1,200 in 2014.
It's upsetting as a Wilmington native. Of course, I know we are not unique. I know it's an issue throughout the country.
There were only three unintentional fatal overdose deaths in New Hanover County in 1999, and 11 times that amount in 2014. Things aren't much better in Pender County, where Turner lives.
My oldest is in high school, and it scares me to death at what he's potentially exposed to on a daily basis. But, I mean, my son will say, oh, yeah, sure, you know, there's people who deal drugs in town and, you know, that type of thing. And it frightens me. You know, the best thing I can do is teach my kids to make good decisions.
This epidemic crosses social lines of all kinds, and its causes are complexly interwoven. Dozens of opioid products are legal through a prescription, but the cost has skyrocketed over the past few years. Doctors have also been more hesitant to write prescriptions for fear of opioid abuse. That puts an especially heavy burden on working-class individuals in rural areas, like eastern North Carolina, who are in chronic physical or psychological pain. To deal with that pain, or just to have a good time in some cases, some go underground. Dr. Sonia Longest, clinical director at the Walter B. Jones Alcohol and Drug Abuse Center, says opioid abuse has been an ongoing problem in the region, but heroin is dominating.
Heroin is more accessible, it's cheaper on the streets, and some of our people who were addicted to the prescription pain meds are now switching to use heroin for those reasons, as opposed to getting treatment.
Heroin is also powerful, thrice as powerful as morphine, according to the World Health Organization. Like most opioids, heroin mimics endorphins, the feel-good chemical in the brain. The initial effects can be euphoric.
It is a significant rush. The person may feel a pleasurable sensation initially, with a heaviness and then a drowsiness that may last for a few hours, some mental cloudiness. They may have a decreased heart rate, slowed breathing. This is the high that people chase.
But it doesn't last. The body develops a tolerance, and simulating that first high becomes more difficult with every hit. Cravings for most are intense and consuming. If more heroin doesn't find its way into the body, it will start to flush it out of the system. The high caused by heroin, along with the torment withdrawal brings, can make individuals suffering from addiction go to great lengths to keep using.
Once the addiction takes over, it is a lifelong chronic and relapsing course, and the person will engage in drug-seeking behaviors no matter what the consequences. It impairs the judgment of someone. They will abandon whatever ethical values that they grew up with just to find the drug and sustain their addiction, even above family and friends.
It's made work for addiction and rehabilitation specialists across the region difficult, but Dr. Longest sees it, in part, as a sign of something positive.
It is much less stigmatized than it has been in years past, especially the heroin, and there are many peer support programs out there to help people in their recovery.
The State Department of Health and Human Services has ramped up its efforts to address the issue and are working with local health departments. Turner says her department is also reaching out to local organizations.
We are trying to address that through, not just through law enforcement, but through our community partners, our faith-based community, our substance abuse programs through those communities, through our school system. It's not like we don't know that it's not happening. We know that it's happening, and we're just trying to wrap our brains around how to, fix it is probably not the right thing to say, but how to address it and how to begin to chip away at it.
Like many epidemics, opioid addiction has no respect for age, race, gender, sexual orientation, or any other distinction. Turner believes people are starting to realize that.
No one is immune. There's anybody who thinks that they don't have this problem to at least a small extent somewhere in their surrounding community, is fooling themselves. That's my opinion, just because it's not out there in your face.
Heroin is one of humanity's oldest narcotics, and it's still one of the most powerful. It's been an ongoing problem elsewhere, the slums, ghettos, and bohemian blocks in the city. But now it's that prevalent on the farms, the fishing docks, and the subdivisions of eastern North Carolina. It's unknown if the region will make a full recovery from the epidemic, but despite rising rates of addiction, Dr. Longest believes there's reason to hope.
There are more people that are becoming addicted, but the good thing is there's also more people that are starting to seek treatment.
I'm Chris Thomas.
Hopefully the clouds are gone, the sun is shining. Next weekend, the Old Front Porch Music Festival will be happening in Oriental. The free event showcases local and regional bands performing on the front porches of many homes and businesses throughout the small harbor town. The music ranges from bluegrass, country, pop, and acoustic, to gospel, reggae, and more. Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with director Dottie Osman about the festival.
How did the idea of performing on front porches at Oriental get its start for that first festival?
My husband and I belong to a bluegrass gospel group called Harbor Sounds, and we had been thinking for a long time of having a music festival in Oriental. And we were going to have it in the various churches. And a friend of mine, Leslie Kellenberger, was out for a run one day. And she came back and she said to me, porches, porches, it has to be on porches.
It began in 2014. How has the growth and participation been like from just a musician's aspect and an audience viewing?
This event was waiting to happen. The first year, I think about 9 porches, probably about 400 people. They loved it. They walked around town. The music just drifted from the porches. The next year, we had about 1,500 people in town. And this year, about half of groups and solo acts are from out of town. So it's about half and half.
Friday night, all the fun gets underway with a ticketed performance by the group Salty Paws at around 6:30 or so, followed by a documentary titled Down from the Mountain, which features bluegrass musicians who performed on the soundtrack to the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Those tickets are very reasonable. They are $5.50.
And we want to remind you once again, that performance is specifically at the Old Theater.
Right, that's correct.
Will these tickets be needed for the festival performances on Saturday as well?
No, that is totally free. There are no tickets. There is no admission charge. We want people to come and have fun. The musicians will have tip jars, and we hope folks will come and enjoy the music.
With at least 25 porches being utilized for the festival, performances, will most of them be concurrent or some of them be separate as well?
We have a website folks can go to. The whole schedule is there. It is Old Front Porch Music Festival. That's OL, not OLD, and it's .org.
What time will the main stage act be performing?
Shiloh Hill performs at 2 o'clock, and the Carmonas, the headliners, perform at 3:30.
In addition to all kinds of bluegrass music, there'll be food and arts and crafts show. It's a village market, and the Rotary Club will have Oriental's old classic car show as well.
A lot to do that day.
I just had to ask this question with all your knowledge and everything else. Long before the Old Front Porch Music Festival began, Oriental already had a rich folk and bluegrass heritage that goes way back to the 1960s and 70s. Tell us about the Truett's Old Country Store where the festival takes its name.
Back in the 60s and the 70s, Captain Billy Truett and his wife Lucille had a wonderful treasure trove of things in their old country store. And on Saturdays, Lucille would call around and she'd say to the local residents, "There's music on the porch tonight. Come on down." The local folks would. They'd bring their chairs and they'd sit around and folks would enjoy the music and some would dance in the street. And it was a wonderful old tradition.
The Old Front Porch Music Festival is made possible through a grant from the North Carolina Arts Council, the Pamlico County Arts Council, and donations from individuals and businesses. And be sure and visit the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org for more information. Dottie, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you for having us, and we just hope everyone comes and enjoys the day.
Everyone keeps talking about how critical the upcoming election is. Ask yourself a question. Where will you turn for reliable, unbiased, and intelligent news and analysis on November 4th? Well, you'll turn to Public Radio East. On October 20th, the PRE Fall Fund Drive begins, and we will turn to you for your annual gift. If you have received pledge information in the mail, turn around and mail your tax-deductible donation today. It's like early voting. Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. It's officially fall, and cooler temperatures are on the way, and our first frost is just around the corner. Statistically, the average first fall frost in southeastern North Carolina occurs the first week of November for inland areas like Jacksonville, Burgaw, and Wallace. The further west we travel in our listening area, the earlier the first frost will occur. For coastal communities, like Swansboro, the first frost does not typically occur until the third week of November, due to the moderating effect of ocean waters. But with that first frost in mind, it's time to prepare your houseplants for the move back indoors for winter. If you moved your houseplants outside for the summer months, you'll want to start bringing them back in when the nighttime lows start to dip down into the 50s. While some houseplants can tolerate lower temperatures, tropical plants can be injured when temperatures drop. The move from outdoors to in results in a change in climate that can cause a shock to your plant's systems. You'll want to acclimate your plants for the move indoors by slowly moving them from sun to light shade and then to heavier shade. This process should take about a week. Now is a good time to bring them in, since the daytime highs are similar to temperatures that many people keep in their homes. However, with our doors and windows kept closed inside, plants will still have to adapt to the change in humidity, since our homes tend to have lower humidity than the out-of-doors. Plants may also stay wetter or drier indoors compared to outdoors. Most of the time, plants show shock to their system by the leaves turning yellow and possibly dropping off. You'll want to inspect plants for pests before bringing them inside. Mealybugs and aphids are two of the most common pests on houseplants. Both can be treated with relatively non-toxic insecticidal soap or horticultural oil. You'll also want to look carefully for fire ants, water bugs, earwigs, and pill bugs before bringing the containers inside. Turn the plant out of the pot and inspect the root ball for hitchhikers before bringing it indoors. You may want to soak the container in a bucket of water for about 20 to 30 minutes. This should drive any soil-dwelling insects out of the root ball. Then you can take the container out and let your plant drain thoroughly for probably half an hour prior to bringing it back indoors. Once in the house, you'll want to keep plants away from the drafts of air conditioner and heater vents. You'll also want to avoid overwatering. Winter is a resting time for houseplants, so wait until spring to divide or repot. If you need to trim your plants back a little, that's fine, but wait until spring to do any severe pruning. With a little planning and thoughtful care, your houseplants should make an uneventful transition back indoors for the winter months.